spirit of the dead, rise up. Lingering spirit of the dead, rise up and possess your bird of passage. Those stolen Africans step out of the ocean, from the wombs of the ships, and claim your story. Spirit of the dead, rise up. Lingering spirit of the dead, rise up and possess your vessel. Those Africans shackled in leg irons and enslaved, step out of the acres of cane fields and cotton fields and tell your story. Spirit of the dead, rise up. Lingering spirit of the dead, rise up and possess your bird of passage. Those lynched in the magnolias, swinging on the limbs of the weeping willows, rotting food for the vultures, step down and claim your story. Spirit of the dead, rise up. Lingering spirit of the dead, rise up and possess your vessel. Those tied, bound, and whipped from Brazil to Mississippi, step out and tell your story. Those in Jamaica, in the fields of Cuba, in the swamps of Florida, the rice fields of South Carolina, you waiting Africans, step out and tell your story. Spirit of the dead, rise up. Lingering spirit of the dead, rise up and possess your bird of passage. From Alabama to Suriname, up to the caves of Louisiana, come out, you African spirits. Step out and claim your stories. You raped, slave bred, castrated, burned, tarred and feathered, roasted, chopped, lobotomized, bound and gagged, you African spirits, spirit of the dead, rise up. Lingering spirit of the dead, rise up and possess your bird of passage.
To you, but this morning we come pouring libation in memory and honor of our ancestors and asking them to intercede with you on our behalf. We know that our ancestors being in the spirit world are closer to you, and there's a greater opportunity that our request will be granted. We ask this morning that you grant the listeners the willingness to open their hearts and their minds to the information that's going to be shared, such that they will hear the truth and then be able to act on the truth. Ancestors, come and get your drink. We say libation. To our ancestors from Mother Africa, the ancestors who were the beginning of the human family that we now have, no matter what your ethnic or cultural background is, the beginning of human life as we know it was on the African continent. Every person on the face of the earth has as their original ancestor an African. We ask those Africans who were the first to conceive of a family, the first to plant a seed, the first to till the land, the first to domesticate animals, the first to navigate the mighty Nile River to Egypt, the first to build a skyscraper, the first to do surgeries, the first to explore the wonders of the galaxy, and as importantly, the first to conceive of the belief in one God. We ask those ancestors to come and be with us today to bring their wisdom, their hard work, their ingenuity to all that we do. Ancestors, come and get your drink. We say libation. To our ancestors who were murdered, displaced, diminished during our great Holocaust, our great Miapa, we do not forget you. We remember your unwilling sacrifice as your bodies are lined the Sahara and the Atlantic Ocean. We remember you and we honor you and we ask that you come and be with us today. Ancestors, come and get your drink. We say libation. We ask our ancestors who gave us the great document, the Ma'at, to come be with us. Bring your additional sense of honor and integrity as embodied by Ma'at to our discussions and our listings this morning. Ancestors, come and get your drink. We say libation. To those ancestors from the Caribbean islands, from Brazil, from the southern parts of these United States, who through your unpaid labor laid the groundwork for the civilizations that are enjoyed by billions of people around the world. To those ancestors, we say we do not forget you. We remember your sacrifice, your hard work, and we ask that you come and be with us today to inspire us to also do the work required to correct a world that has gone mad. Ancestors, come and get your drink. We say libation. And to those ancestors who are yet to be born, those ancestors for whom we do good work, those ancestors to whom we pledge to honorably do righteous work all the time for ourselves, for our families, for our communities, so we can be correct to be able to benefit from the largesse that the Creator has provided for all of us. Ancestors, we pledge ourselves to continue to do work such that when you return, this place will be a better earth. Ancestors, come and get your drink. We say, libation. And finally, we'd like to ask you and our audience to think of one of your ancestors, someone who you would like to be with us this morning. On the count of three, ask that ancestor to come and be with us. One, two, three. Ancestors, come and get your drink. We said libation, libation, libation. It is good.
People use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Brother Alfonso.
Hey, Baba. Sorry about that, Bob. Just unmuted. Peace and blessings, family. Once again, it's truly always a pleasure and an honor to be with you all on this Saturday evening. Thank you all for taking the time out on such a, it's a beautiful day here in Milwaukee. So those here in Milwaukee who are taking the time out, thank you for tuning in. The fellowship with us and talk about this very serious subject matter that we're going to touch on today. This is a production of Black Think Tank, Dr. Rogers' Black Think Tank family. This is a production from the within the context of the family. This is the Elders of Sankofa production. And the Elders of Sankofa is a collective group of elders here in the community. We're organizing to once again be a voice of wisdom and knowledge in our community. So I would always like to just start off with the purpose of the council. And it is to use African principles of unity and cooperation to create a healing environment for our community by addressing environmental and social conditions and human disparities we face. Through the guidance of the Elders of Sankofa, these principles will provide a unifying ideology for the collective mission in building a unified front with one voice in the city of Milwaukee. The mission of the Sankofa Council of Milwaukee, to engage, aid, and assist each other and the continuous development of a movement and network of elders who are governed by the principles of Ma'at and the Nguga Saba, seven principles of Kwanzaa, as we move through the 21st century. The role and function of the Sankofa Council of Milwaukee will be to provide formation of policy and the development of programs and services, which will continue to contribute to the growth, self-governance, and economic empowerment of the African-American community here in Milwaukee. The main tenet of the Sankofa Council of Elders is the think tanks. And the role and the mission of the think tanks are to critically analyze our environment and social conditions in the city through research and create proactive strategies, solutions to address the circumstances and disparities. Each think tank will consist of members who have a particular interest, level, and expertise and experience within those areas of science. Each member of this Sankofa Council of Milwaukee will commit to actively participating and supporting the think tank. So once again, we are attempting to do, it's nothing new what we're doing here. I'm sure there's other elders of Sankofa or Council of Elders in other cities. So we would love to collaborate and network with other organizations that's doing this. So just always want to start off with that. I know our introduction is long, but we are African people. And even in our hardship, we always celebrate and honor our creator and our ancestors. I'm going to say that again. Even in our hardship, we always honor and celebrate our creator and our ancestors through dance and through music. So that's the purpose of, once again, the introduction. And once again, that's a ritual. That's a tradition in African culture. We always also have an ancestral profile. And today's ancestral profile is the late, great Baba Dr. Amos N. Wilson. Professor Amos N. Wilson is a former social worker, supervising probation officer, psychological counselor, training administrator in the New York City Department of Juvenile Justice, and assistant professor of psychology at the City University of New York. Born in Hattiesburg, Mississippi in 1941, Amos Nelson Wilson completed his undergrad degree in psychology at Morehouse College in Atlanta, Georgia. He migrated to New York, where he mastered at the Fordham University and the New School for Social Research before attaining his doctorate from Fordham, Bronx, New York, in the field of general theoretical psychology. Dr. Wilson taught courses in general developmental, adolescent, abnormal, social, personality, and cognitive psychology. Thinking and writing skills development provided personal and academic counseling, research, and designed youth and adult rehabilitation programs. His ambition and further as it availed himself for numerous appearances at educational, cultural, and political organizations and universities throughout the U.S., also Canada and the Caribbean. He readily tutored at the Harlem School of Africana Studies, a university founded by the Emirate First World Alliance. Brother Amos active transcend academia into the field of business, owning and operating various enterprises in Greater New York. Colleagues lay the professional recently acclaimed him the ultimate Garveyite. A prolific writer, Wilson has penned other pertinent works in education, economics, and theoretical and therapeutic psychology, which we hope to share with readers and admirers in the near future. Once again, the late, great Dr. Amos Wilson. Dr. Wilson left a number of books with us for us to study and to further our research. Just to name a few of them, one of them is Black on Black Violence, The Psychodynamics of the Black Self-Annihilation in Service of White Domination. Another one of his books is The Developmental Psychology of the Black Child. Another one of his books is Awakening the Natural Genius in Black Children, African-Centered versus the New World Order. There's another one of his books, The Falsification of African Consciousness. And the volume book that we all, and Dr. Rogers that did a piece on this one, Blueprint for Black Power. Once again, Dr. Amos Wilson left some good work. So those of us who are students of psychology, his books are truly books you need in your library to study and get a better understanding of what we as the descendants of kidnapped and enslaved Africans are experiencing. Today's subject is looking at the sociopathic personality configuration and the social deviant behaviors that in Black males, and the escalation of violence, the level of violence that we see in younger brothers. And part of what we have to understand, family, is that the social construction of reality within this European social construct, the foundation of it within racism is to destroy the Black male and his family. And we have to deal with that with that reality and have to understand that the Europeans, there's an element of their race that understands that they have to continuously attack the Black male in his family and his woman and keep a division between him and his woman. So part of what we're going to talk about today is understanding that social construct of what that is. The when you talk about a social construct, social pathology that comes with that construct. And the social pathology is the reality of how the environment, the social conditions that are created by legislation, laws, and policies, how that creates certain behaviors in the individuals that live in that society. But specifically how those social pathologies and the ideology of racism, how the internalized racism, the impact that is having on the development of Black males, is what we're going to have a conversation about this evening. And coming up with the prognosis of that and understanding what a prognosis is just recognizing that our young brothers, our brothers and sisters are infected with a disease that, once again, that they're not born with. So we have to understand that there's something happening in the socialization of our people, of us, that's creating the behaviors that we're seeing. And from a Black African developmental perspective, is looking at that through a lens of not just saying that there's something genetically wrong with us, but there's something wrong with the environment, something wrong with the society, something's wrong with the educational system as it relates to how, what type of human being we, that is being produced. But part of what we have to do is understand how this the social construct is constructed. Then we got to recognize how do we deconstruct it, and then what do we reconstruct it with? And those of us who are students of Pan-Africanism and Black nationalism recognize the reconstruction component that we need is that Black nationalism and Pan-Africanism. So part of what we're doing, once again, is having a conversation out of an African worldview or African perspective. I'm going to read some definitions, and then I'm going to get to my guest, one of my brothers who's been putting work in here in the community, is Dr. Mark Fawcett. I want to read some definitions so we can all have the same frame of reference as we think about what is happening to ourselves as well as to our young brothers. I want to read the definition of psychological warfare. To denote any action which is practiced mainly by psychological methods, with the aim of evoking a planned psychological reaction in other people. Various techniques are used and aimed at influencing a target audience's values, beliefs, and emotional systems, motives, reasoning, and behavior. It is used to reinforce attitudes and behaviors favorable to the original objective. So when we look at the behaviors that we see in these young brothers, the behavior is favorable to the society. It's beneficial for the young brothers to be doing or acting the way they act. Another definition we need to understand is brainwashing and propaganda. Brainwashing is a systematic, applied, coerced technique used to change the belief or behaviors of one or more persons, usually for political or religious purposes. Propaganda is a form of communication often biased or misleading in nature, aimed toward influencing the attitude of a population towards some cause, position, or political agenda. So as we had this conversation, we have to understand the media and the entertainment field, the propaganda that they display or create the image that we are criminals is part of that propaganda piece. Mind control and manipulation. Mind control is the coercive persuasion, thought control of thought reform. This is the theoretical indoctrination process which results in the impairment of the autonomy and inability to think independently and a disruption of the belief, morals, and values. And we have to pay attention, Fabi. A common word, a common thing in this is our beliefs, our morals, and our values. That's the common thing of what psychological warfare is. And the last one is hypnosis. Hypnosis is an alteration in the sensation, perception, thoughts, feelings, or behaviors brought about by a suggestion interpreted as a trance, altered state of consciousness. So I just want to give us, once again, a frame of reference to build this conversation in. So as we move into this conversation, we'll recognize that the condition that we're seeing our people in, conditions or behaviors that we're seeing in our young brothers is not a result of something genetically wrong with them. There is a social engineering process that is taking place that is creating the behaviors that we're seeing in our young brothers. So without further ado, I'm going to bring in my brother, my big brother, Dr. Mark Fawcett. How you doing, big brother?
I'm doing well, brother. Hotel.
So glad to have you with us, man. And once again, I'm going to get out the way and go and let you do what you do. Could you share a little bit about yourself and then once again go into your clinic, your work history, and then we can build up this conversation.
Sure. I'm president and CEO of a mental health substance abuse clinic in the community. We've been always on the north side. We're Vail Phillips Avenue, called M&S Clinical Services since 1995. We provide assessments for alcohol and drugs and mental health. Also, we provide psychotherapeutic intervention for people in our community and people throughout the Milwaukee County area. I've done this since 1983, so I've been around the block for a while. Cut my teeth working with Vietnam veterans, to which I'm a Vietnam era veteran, and from there spent off working with adolescents and families, and I'm a family therapist myself, a licensed marathon family, and I look at our relationship with one another systemically. In other words, not as individuals, but as a group, and you heal as a group, and you've gotten sick as a group by another group who we've been oppressed by. And I'm also a bishop in God's church and a proponent of what is called Black theological theology, which is an empowerment of Black people, not the disempowerment of Black people. I'm glad to be here. I'm looking at the curriculum which was laid out, and it is true that our ancestor, Dr. Amos Wilson, gave us a lot to work with, and a lot of misconceptions have come about working with, you know, our people. Also, one of the other things that I do and our clinic does primarily is alcohol and drug treatment, but, you know, not just the treatment, but we challenge and tackle the policies that are created around keeping our community suppressed, even in terms of policies that have been created. And I'll specifically talk maybe later about this whole issue of the opiate epidemic versus treatment in our in the larger community, in the white community, and criminalization when it was our problem. And now that's a priority on a national and local level, people who are suffering in our community with alcohol, crack cocaine, and marijuana, which is still prevalent, has been ignored, and priority and dollars have been put into those particular avenues, which is important because if people can't get rehabilitation and treatment, that's also part of that whole element of white supremacy, who's better than who. They're even called priority clients. So there's some deep-seated stuff that goes on when you're dealing with institutional racism and systems that purport to have to say that race is a disease and disparity, but in reality, they're still working out of the same social engineering that Brother Alfonso was talking about, suppression and oppression of our people. And I believe we as Black clinicians have an obligation to speak on these things, to address them. I know when I'm doing diagnosis, as many times there's people who have come to other systems, particularly public systems, who have been misdiagnosed from different type of medications, treatments, or lack of treatments. And so our people are oftentimes are not really receiving the services that they're supposed to receive. And then on top of that, you know, some of the modalities are not relevant to us, you know, as a people. And obviously, we need more psychosocial empowerment, such as institutions that, you know, speak to our needs and things of that nature. So tonight's going to be a real interesting topic. It's just a kind of a overview of what I do and where I'm at.
All right. Thank you, brother. Thank you. I know you've been in the game a while. Me and you are from Milwaukee. Both of us have worked within the context of the system here and being able to engage with the court system, the probation officers, the House of Corrections, the DT, Ethan Allen, Lincoln Hills. Both of us have been able to be in these spaces. So you were sharing earlier about what you were seeing with working in some of the residential treatments as it relates to some of the young brothers. Could you share a little bit about that?
Sure. In my earlier career, I worked in a place, it's not in existence. It was called Child and Adolescent Treatment Center. It's a mental health portion for children and adolescents sponsored by Milwaukee County. And what I saw there was our youth back to being misdiagnosed. But one something that really stood out with me was a unit called the F unit, F for forensic. And many of the black males were diagnosed with a diagnosis called conduct disorder or oppositional defiance. And as I would look at the white youth, they may have had those type of diagnoses, but they would have something like dysthymia, depression, things of that nature, anxiety, to where they were deemed as being treatable and many times being addressed with whether it's medication or psychotherapy. For the other youth were basically through the mental health system being channeled and sent to, you know, various correction institutions like Wells, Ethan Allen, Lincoln Hills, and the sort. And it just kind of, you know, grabbed me how blatant that system was. And, you know, we talked about being in the system for a while. I went to various other group homes settings and saw the same pattern being carried out. Basically housing our youth who would get in trouble, but not necessarily treating or providing educational or vocational skills that would enable them to A, be empowered, and B, to have knowledge itself, or just have rudimentary knowledge. You know, a 17-year-old is reading at a third grade level, and that was okay, you know, for those institutions because they were getting per diems and stuff. So you see those type of injustices, and you wonder why our adult systems are filled now. Mm-hmm. And as I moved along my journey, unfortunately, in these systems, they kind of recycle people. And you would see some of the same people that you treated as an adolescent as adults. So, you know, it's...
Yeah. So from your clinical experience, clinical expertise, what would you say is the rationale or some of the reasoning why some of the escalation with brothers shooting sisters, setting children on fire? We didn't used to do that kind of stuff, man. What would you contribute to that?
I think there's an escalation of rage that we had never saw before. I'm 65, so I can kind of date myself to say that, you know, at least in this town, and even when I lived in Detroit, it wasn't that bad, that, you know, there was a sense of family, there was a sense of groundedness, and we have lost that, you know. And to be honest with you, I believe even the spirit of the people that we are imitating has become more, we've become more pronounced in that. We've become what we have projected that is normal and healthy to be. In other words, we don't have an Afrocentric viewpoint or model to put our children or our people in, so we are acting out in a way that we've never acted out before because we really have no healthy venue to model as what is healthy or not healthy, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. And as I'm listening to you, I'm just thinking about when you, those of us who are attempting to practice Sankofa, and that Sankofa just simply means to seek divine knowledge of self or seek knowledge of self. When you are practicing that, there's a paradigm shift in your relationship to the reality that we're functioning in. So part of what that I'm noticing with our people, since they don't have an alternative reality, just like you said, that they don't have an alternative culture to function out of, they're picking up it's a psychopathic personality disorder that they're picking up. And so part of what we have to begin to understand is how do we begin to come up with practices or theoretical modalities. But I want to read the definition of sociopathic. So we have an understanding, because a lot of times we assume people know what we're talking about, but we got to give people a frame of reference to shape their reality. So I'm going to read sociopath. A sociopath, his conduct often brings him into conflict with society. The psychopath is driven by primitive desires and exaggerated craving for excitement. In his self-centered search for pleasure, he ignores restrictions of his culture. A psychopath sociopath is highly impulsive. He is a man of whom the moment is a segment of time detached from all others. His actions are unplanned and guided by his whim. The psychopath is aggressive and has learned few socialized ways of coping with frustration. The psychopath feels little, if any, guilt. He can commit the most appalling acts, yet view them without remorse. The psychopath has a warped view of love. His emotional relationships, when they exist, are meager, fleeing, and designed to satisfy his own desires. So I just wanted to read that, because what we have to recognize, like you were just articulating, Big Bro, is that since we're not functioning out of our cultural paradigm, we're taking on the personality configurations of the culture. But the European culture cultivates our spirit and our personality. And so we're seeing the behaviors of our brothers who are emulating the behaviors of Europeans.
And what is so interesting about that, Brother Alfonso, is that I did pick up the book. I was tempted not to buy it, but Mary L. Trump wrote about her her uncle, who is our president now. And the book says, "Too Much and Never Enough." You just described him. But because of white privilege, they're able to do the same things that you're talking about and escape the consequences of criminality in many cases.
Right.
I think I was muted.
Yeah, you're back in, brother.
Okay. What I just said, did that go, or should I repeat it?
You can repeat it, brother.
Okay. I said that, you know, the definition that you just described, my brother, describes our president right now, sociopathic, narcissistic. But because of institutional or racism in our society, they're able to have privilege, if you want to call it that, to get away with things. So we are attracting criminal justice systems and so on and so forth at a much higher rate by exhibiting that type of behavior, whereas they do not go in that channel. They go into business. They go into presidencies. They go into corporate ladders and things of that nature. But you just described white privilege in its highest.
Right, right, right. And as we had this conversation, when we get opportunity to break bread with the family, how do we begin to support, identify what we're seeing in our brothers? Because, I mean, I know in some cases, many of our brothers are so damaged, it's going to be difficult to rehabilitate them when they get to a certain point in their development. But could you touch on some of the things that you, I know you read some of Amos Wilson stuff, but did you share some of what you read in his book?
Well, yeah, I can. And I think the rehabilitation is the key word, because re means to go back to, and habilitation means wellness. In many cases, it goes back to your earlier question of sometimes we have to even teach wellness to our clients and to our people now. So we're at a whole different level where, you know, before you could be rehabilitated by training up a child, and when they leave, they'll return to the ways that you trained them. But now we are working out of a paradigm where, you know, many of our youth have not even received those type of levels of nurturance, guidance, and to raise themselves. So I did want to kind of touch on that.
Uh-huh.
You know, we're not dealing with people who are necessarily cold and icy, but who have not been given the appropriate human nature things that come along with development into the human being that we are and that our ancestors have raised us to be. But some of the things that Dr. Wilson talked about, some of the psychological effects of white racism and us being in this particular jungle, is chronic anger, chronic frustration, chronic conflict and ambivalence, that is, not knowing who we are, what we are, displaced aggression, which we see all the time with the murders and the killing. And when you asked the brother, why did he shoot? Well, he he dissed me and things of that nature, you know. We don't know who to be mad at, so we feel comfortable being mad at ourselves. Internalized racist attitudes towards each other, you know. That means I turn inwardly the hatred that I have for myself onto someone who is like me. And what really kind of gave me one that I really thought about was consumer orientation, that we derive our power through conspicuous consumption. And so we don't even spend in our own community or with ourselves, but, you know, we spend a lot of our time, you know, trying to make up and do makeovers, and our value of who we are is based on what we wear, where we drive, not necessarily who we are. And again, we weren't always like that. You know, we valued family, we valued our spirituality. And so, it's the more we move towards away from ourselves, the more we move towards who we really aren't.
That's a good point, brother. The next question I want, and it'll lead into the next hour, is the assault, the psychological warfare. There's intellectual warfare, and now we have to start understanding that this European mad scientist is chemical warfare, and part of what we have to understand is that they have created poisons and toxics that interfere with the natural processes of our genetics. And so part of what we're seeing as well is that the poisoning of our brothers and sisters is also a reflection in this behavior, with them being not being able to have the necessary emotional regulation, the impulse control. Those things are impacted by the chemical warfare. So, brother, could you touch on that a little bit?
Well, I mean, we can just look at this, I don't call it what they call it. I call this plague that is that's existing now. And I thought what was interesting was one of the most essential institutions was the alcohol industry. They never shut down. And there's a method to that madness, that they can keep us anesthetized, particularly in our community, because you have liquor stores and taverns on top of each other, and everybody is making money. I think the trick to the enemy is the legalization of marijuana.
Close the door.
And the THC content.
Close the door. No, you go out and close it.
The outpour of more and more designer drugs, and, you know, crack cocaine has not left our community. The war on drugs never was a war. It was a war on our people, because when Clinton, he called the first black president, many of us had the war on drugs. It was basically to buy more police material and give more time. That also fits into the fact that, you know, our community is inundated with illicit drugs and all of the behaviors that go along with that, to include criminal behaviors and things of that nature. It's by conspiracy, and not by, you know, some type of underground insidious process that this is going on. But one of the things, and I think if we really look at the invent of the 40 ounce. We know that alcohol and drugs, well, all chemical dependency has to do with your tolerance. And so maybe when I was growing up, we sipped on a 6 ounce or an 8 ounce. Our children are starting off with more higher potent malt liquors, and they're starting off. Their baseline is higher, with like 40 ounces, 80 ounces. And it's coming to fruition that over a generation, we have youth in their 30s with liver problems and things of that nature, because clearly alcohol does that to one's body and stuff. And as you indicated before, Brother Alfonso, the inability to cope with stress, and you're using substances to anesthetize those feelings and those thoughts. it's clear, you know, that, you know, that's the war we're fighting. And then the addiction process is there, which tears down families, health, so on, and the spiritual and moral fiber of our community.
Right. Part of what we have to, once again, start to recognize that the social and economic stressors, so you got external stressors and you got internal stressors, but the research is starting to show that the effect on the psychobiological functioning of our bodies is being impacted by the, it's called environmental and social toxicity. And I'm going to read the definition of that, family. Refers to the extent to which a social environment in which families develop and operate is so poisonous in the sense that it contains serious threats to the development of identity, competencies, moral reasoning, trust, hope, and other features of personality and the ideology that makes for successful human development. So part of what we have to begin to understand is that the assault on us is on such a level that a lot of times we don't get opportunity to go in depth to what is really happening to us and what has happened to us so that we can begin to come up with these theoretical modalities or come up with the necessary research to address the circumstances that we're dealing with. So part of, once again, is recognizing the assault on us with the chemical warfare. The chemical warfare is altering the personality of our people.
Right.
Can you want to touch on that, big brother?
Well, I think you did service it well by saying that you know that's what chemicals in fact does. It destroys the very essence of, you know, our thought processes, and some of that has to do with, you know, it rearranges also genetically your body, your chemical, your testosterone, your estrogen. So it has a bigger effect than just getting high and being irrational. The toxicity of just stress itself can rearrange your body functions and open up us to all kind of other things like cancer, other things that, you know, weaken our immune system, which again, this plague supposedly does, you know, attack those things that are akin to weak immune systems, the way we eat, not just the illicit drugs we take, but some of even the drugs that we take that are not of natural course and stuff. So it gets real, you know, deep. Stress will certainly alterate our chemical and give us chemical imbalance.
Right. And so as we think about and recognize the level of violence that we are seeing in our brothers, and now that we are able to once again look at it from a clinical perspective, is understanding that we are going to have to and I know my brother, you had mentioned, we're going to go into that in the second half, being able to control the facilitation of the or the institutions that provide the services necessary to our people. Because if we don't fail to recognize that the personality configurations that are being shown or displayed in our brothers and sisters, this is a necessity for this society. They continue. Capitalism creates a personality configuration that is beneficial to the system. So the system benefits off us being dysfunctional. So it's not in their best interest to make an investment to change or improve our behaviors and our condition. Go ahead, brother.
Oh, sir. Or put people in play. Are in places that would, you know, for lack of a better word, oversee those type of institutions that would, you know, perpetuate a oneness of our people. I think that's a strong element of what we're dealing with as well, family. That oftentimes we have people that look like us, they don't think like us, the Sankofos, and African-oriented and African-centered people who continuously perpetuate what, you know, the system designs for us to be and do.
Yeah, that's real talk. They become agents for white supremacy. They become agents for racism. And so that's another conversation we're going to have as it relates to, even though somebody may be melanated, if they're not practicing Sankofa, if they ain't having talking Pan-Africanism or Black nationalism, they really are not, and really to a certain extent, don't have the necessary mindset to do what's necessary to support the people.
Yes, sir.
This is the top of the hour, family. So we are
are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Hotel family, once again, it is always truly an honor and a blessing to be with y'all. Understanding that my mic keep going in and out, I'm going to get some new equipment, but I always say, family, these Europeans are not going to allow us to use their technology to start or continue our revolution. So I'm going to work on getting some new equipment so that, once again, hopefully that my mic going in and out will get better. But we are listening to, once again, Time for Awakening Internet Radio Broadcast. It's a platform that is part of Black Talk Radio Network. We are part of the Elders of Sankofa are part of the Black Reality Think Tank Radio Network. And so, once again, we are thankful for y'all participating in this. But there are a number of radio programs that are offered on Time for Awakening Media Group. On Mondays, our dear brother, one of my mentors, Baba Oshi, hosts African Perspective, and that's from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. African Perspectives on Monday. That's Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays. Brother Oshi, African Perspectives, from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. Access of Diamonds, that's hosted by Brother Jihad Ahmed. Once again, Access of Diamonds, that's 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. A new broadcast by some brilliant Black African psychologists. The host of that is Dr. Queen Mother Kambung, Kabong. She is shy, beautiful sister. Truly, I'm hoping they start recording. I don't know if they're recording the programs, but I hope they start recording so we can go back and listen to them, because they are really dropping some science as it relates to Black African developmental psychology. And her show, once again, is on Mondays from 8 p.m. to 9. From 9 to 10 is Conversation Reparations. That's the first and third Mondays. On Tuesdays from 8 to 10, Black Reality Think Tank. That's Dr. William Rogers. That's p.m. So it's 8 to 10, Black Reality Think Tank. On Thursdays, it's another family member of the Black Reality Think Tank. Is after 7, and that's hosted by some young sisters, Shannon B. And they talk about things in their generations, that in their generation, that are relevant and prevalent to them. On Fridays, once again, 8 p.m. to 10, it's Time for an Awakening. That's with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. Fridays from 8 p.m. to 10. And today you are listening to Saturday's weekend edition. The first one was from 4 to 6, Black Reality Think Tank Weekend Edition. And right now you're listening to Elders of Sankofa and Brother Alfonso Watkins. And we are on from 6 to 8 Central Time. And Sundays, 7 p.m. to 9, is Time for an Awakening again. That's with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. And once again, our shows, the information that's being disseminated is coming from a Pan-Africanist, Black Nationalist perspective. And we always want to give a shout out and honor to Brother Elliot for his vision of keeping or having a platform for us to be able to have these type of exchanges and dialogues. And once again, Brother Elliot, thank you for your commitment and dedication to the Black African community. And a program that is coming in August is called the Black Farmers Program. That's coming in August, the Black Farmers Program. But once again, family, those are the Time for Awakening programs throughout the week. Once again, I am here with my brother, Dr. Mark Fossey. We are having a conversation talking about the psychopathic personality configuration of Black males and the social deviant behaviors that we're seeing in Black males and in our communities. Part of, once again, what me and Bob, Dr. Foss is attempting to do is start, really, this is really a workshop that we're trying to put into a two-hour radio program. But just trying to have a conversation, or having a conversation from a Black perspective as Black males who are providing services in the community to with these young brothers, and having some exchanges with them. So I'm going to get my brother back on the line here, Brother Fawcy.
Yes, sir.
All right, man, back with you, brother. So the second half of the conversation, is we're going to probably go about another 15, 20 minutes, and then I'm going to open the lines up for brothers and sisters to ask questions, have some conversation. But I would like to spend a little more time on the, you mentioned the opiate epidemic, mm-hmm. but also what you're seeing as it relates to the, I'm going to say the explosion or the continued a plague, as you mentioned, with the weed, the alcohol, the heroin that's impacting our community. And the other piece of it is the reality that when we was coming up, but this younger generation, they engage in some things that, you know, even at my age, I'm scared to mess with. So if you can touch on some of that so we can go into the, what we're seeing with the behaviors.
Yeah, well, to start off with the first point that you made, Brother Alfonso, is that opiates have been in our community since the 30s. Generally narrowed down to, like, entertainers and people who are in the streets, players and things of that nature. And the original hype or junkie was one who was IV drug user. If you look at Lady Sings the Blues, depicted those type of behaviors of a certain group, but it wasn't an issue throughout the community. Around about the Vietnam era, there was an influx of heroin coming from Southeast Asia, and I know here they had a lot of influx of heroin in Detroit. They had what is called the penny capsule for a dollar, which is the size of a contact capsule. You could buy heroin, and people did get addicted. Then came the onset of the crack, the cocaine, which became common and used as a very highly addictive substance in our community. That never went away. I'm not suggesting that we are not using, we as a group are not using heroin or opiate-based stuff like, you know, the young kids are drinking what they call lean, which is kind of a cough syrup. Back in our days, we drank Robitussin AC and so on and so. By the way, I'm a recovering addict, so I have an experiential as well as a clinical knowledge of these things, and so I can walk down the history with it. But in our community, heroin is not epidemic in the sense that it is in the white community. When it was epidemic in our community, it was criminalized. So people went to prison for the possession and the use of heroin or opiates. Now they've considered opiates, because it has opened up to the suburbs and various other groups, a disease of the brain. You must treat it. And there's all kind of different, you know, what they call maintenance programs to assist one coming off. And I'm not opposed to that, but here's where the opposition comes. In public health, at least, in which our agency, we're an access point, as it's called, and we place people based upon their criteria of addiction, we're finding that we have to give preference to people who have opiate addictions versus cocaine and alcohol and marijuana and some of the other drugs that are prevalent in our community. What that basically does is means that we're, with public dollars, we're treating a group outside that has never been given treated. In other words, white folks is getting their needs met because of all this money poured into the system, whereas Black people put on what is called wait lists. And if you know anything about a person who is addicted, when they're ready to get appropriate treatment, you can't put them on a wait list or lower the type of treatment modality that they should have. So most people who are addicted to these substances should be in places like residential treatment centers, but they're reserved now for people who have, you know, generally have opiate addictions and stuff. So you can see it's almost like when they were doing the war on crime, a rock would get you, 4 rocks would get you 40 years, 4 grams of powder would get you maybe 5 years. White folks use powder, black folks use rocks. It's the same type of inequitable policies that are being presented with the dollars, and it's really killing our community. And it's really those of us who are providers, we're just sitting there with our mouth open saying, this is not fair, but they would say, well, this is what the dollars have been, you know, created for, and we can't do anything about it. So anyone who's listening, if you have someone who is strung out on cocaine or some other substances, they are not, at least through the public system, they are not receiving generally the adequate care because they're on wait lists. We have people like 400 people on a wait list right now in Milwaukee County waiting to be placed in appropriate care, and they'll never get there because tomorrow there'll be 420. So if that doesn't, you know, look like social policy inequity, I don't know what it is, you know. The effect, of course, is that as long as a person uses drugs and alcohol, they make poor decisions. So children aren't being taken care of. You know, there's an escalation of CPS, Child Protective Service calls, criminal activity goes on. Again, we're talking about internalized racism. People aren't going outside of the community. They're going inside of the community and doing these things that are drug-related. And last but not least, the health factors that happens when a person cannot receive appropriate rehabilitation. So the disparity is all around. That's what I'm seeing. That's what I'm working with.
Yeah, brother, that's real. And once again, I'm glad we got you in the space to articulate what's going on that level. Another piece, and I'm going to ask you this question, and then we're going to go to the lines and let the brothers and sisters chime in. There's a, as our brothers, with the young brothers who are displaying these behaviors, there's a science that's called behavioral nudging or behavioral personality modification. Mm-hmm. We are not aware of. And that behavior modification science is the video game that our children are playing, are programmed to do or to display the behaviors that they're seeing in the video game. So, working with a lot of young brothers, when they are on the drug and they're driving the car, many of them go into their subconscious. They go into Grand Theft Auto. They go into driving like they. So, did you talk to that brother?
Yeah, they actually have a video game, and I learned a lot from my adolescent and young clients and stuff because, you know, I'm old school. I said, what are y'all doing? What's this? They have a game where you actually are trying to run the light or you're trying not to get hit. You know, to them, and imagine their reality is in these games or shooting somebody, you know. It depersonalized what is really dangerous and, because, you know, you're dealing with a lot of other cognitive delays based upon, you know, a whole lot of stuff like trauma, a whole lot of stuff like, you know, drug-induced behaviors. They take this as, you know, something that's... Well, those games reinforce the behaviors in which you see them acting out. It's sad, but it's true.
Yeah, it's real. It's real. And I always share with people that when I was in the Marines, the video game Call of Duty was used for urban warfare training. So when we were being trained... To go into urban areas, first thing we did though, that we watched and played on the video game. Mm-hmm. And then we took that assimilation and took that out into the field and practiced that. But I'm just saying to the listening audience, we have to understand that the things that we are doing as a nation, it's not just, we are programming, our young boys are being programmed to be killers. They're being programmed, the behavior that we see with them running the light, just swerving from something. That's all part of, once again, them playing those video games. And that's a science, and you can do the research on it. It's called behavioral personality nudging or behavioral personality modification.
Yep.
So this
Brother Alfonso, you're going in and out. You're going in and out.
Yeah, and once again, man, I know my equipment it's been doing that. So I'm gonna do the best I can. I'm gonna get some more equipment. Also. But I'm gonna go let you come finish your comment, and then we go to the line.
I'm through.
Okay. Clear. Okay. So what I'm gonna do, family, is I got some lines that are from out of town. I'll say your area code and then your first three numbers, and then for in town, for the walking calls, I'm gonna say your last four numbers. So this is for your last four numbers. So I'm gonna start with the phone call from Greensboro, 336-317. You got any questions or comments? You got any questions or comments?
Hello.
Yes, we can hear you.
Yes, peace. I would like to comment in about 10 minutes because I'm actually driving and I don't want any disturbance. So I'll try to press that star key twice in about 10 minutes.
Okay, I'll come back to you.
Okay, brother.
All right, peace.
Peace.
Milwaukee call 6051. Milwaukee 6051. Any questions or comments? Milwaukee 7117. Milwaukee 7117. Any questions or comments? Milwaukee 5924. Any questions or comments?
Yes. Can you hear me pretty good?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Dr. Fossey, I had a question in regards to you talked about the effects of the 40 ounce and so forth,
yes,
the 80 ounce, and I don't know if you could elaborate on that a little more in regards to the consumption rate and the type of effect that has on a person versus people that, get a 8 ounce or a 12 ounce can, something to that effect.
Sure.
I mean, like I said, I understand that this stuff is done by design, but if you could elaborate on that a little more.
Yes, sir. Well, one of the constituents of addiction is tolerance. One of the ways we define how a person becomes addicted is their ability to take in a certain chemical and not have the effect that, you know. So, for instance, when I was drinking an 8 ounce and it got me high, okay, after time, 8 ounces, I would need 12 ounces to, you know, get the same effect. So if you start off with a higher level of, in this case, alcohol, and more potent, by the way, because most of the beers are power malts that are in our community and stuff like that, and it's really pushed marketing booze to blacks. But you're starting off, your baseline is no longer 8 ounces, but it's 80 ounces. So the
right.
same 80 ounce that took me to... After a while, I'll build a tolerance for 80 ounces. I may need 120 ounces to get the same effect that 80 ounces gave me. So you see the cumulative effect of addiction.
Yes, and it just brings me back to thinking about all the commercials back in the day with Slitz Malt Liquor Beer and the 40 ounce and how, you know, advertisement wise and so forth. I mean, it stayed in your mind though. So
right.
that was one of the things that they also did. And then on my end, working as law enforcement, the consumption rate in regards to intoxication and among the people in the area in which I work, which is predominantly white, it was a very large high concentration of people that were drinking intoxicants from minors to adults. And we, you know, we had a very few minorities, but the arrest of the minorities would surpass that of the whites. you know. And so from a law enforcement perspective and stuff, I mean, they were targeted even then.
All right. Thanks for your question, big bro.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, bro. Montgomery, Alabama, 334-414. You got a question or comment?
Yes, sir. Good evening, gentlemen. It's a pleasure to be online again. Uhuru Brothers, the question that I have is with regards to in line of therapeutics or therapy. You mentioned the word hypnosis. First of all, do black people have a what's called maybe like a therapeutic index of sorts? That a level in which they could be able to be treated, if that makes sense. And two, how has hypnosis or can hypnosis be used as a therapy or some high frequency items such as like chimes or maybe even bells of sorts that could help in the process of cleaning people up or redirecting their energies in such a way?
Yeah. I personally do not use hypnosis as a therapeutic paradigm. My thoughts is more the cognitive behavior. As a man thinketh, so he is in his heart. So I work with people reconstructing their attitudes, their thoughts, and their values and decision-making processes and stuff. For some, hypnosis does work. I don't practice it. Some of it has to do with liability. Some of it has to do with, you know. But I think the context in which hypnosis was being used in this particular case was not as a therapeutic process, if I'm not mistaken, Brother Fonzo, but hypnosis and us being, how would I say, entangle into, you know, a mind process in a negative way. Am I right or wrong?
Yes, that's what I was using it to get us to be aware of that. Now, and to answer the question, I mean, to go a little more in depth with your question, those of us who are students of Black African developmental psychology say Elijah Muhammad, it was a master psychologist. And what we meant by that, he recognized that you had to detox and cleanse brothers and sisters of the poisons that were in their body to take them through a process of detoxification. Because once again, the chemical warfare that we're dealing with is going to require us to recognize that the practices of detoxification, fasting, cleansing is going to have to be part of this process, because just talk therapy or cognitive restructuring type of therapy, if the individuals who have these chemical addictions, first we have to cleanse that. We have to get them to cleanse their body of those addictions, that dependency on that. So hypnosis may work with some people, but if you have a chemical dependency, and Big Bro can talk to this, many people that when we get the cases, they have a dual diagnosis.
Right.
So they have a physical addiction, then they have a mental illness.
Okay.
So can you touch on that, Big Bro?
Yeah, we call it co-occurrency, that, you know, one doesn't go without the other. In fact, I've never met anyone addicted that doesn't have mental health issues, anxiety or whatever. And you're correct, you know, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad was good with telling us to detox, you know, the way we eat, abstaining from alcohol and tobacco and drugs and things of that nature. When you clean a man's body up or woman's body up, and then you can touch their mind. There is a relationship between both. You know. Most people use because they have mental health issues for the onset of. Did that answer your question, brother?
Yeah. Well, I was just with regards to how do you work towards a solution, and what are some things that can be implemented towards redirecting especially those who may not be within the Black African centered African centered thought sure. process? Is there something that can be done? You know, is there aromatherapies or crystals or bells of some sort in addition to a talk therapy to be able to get people to change their dynamic or change their positioning and redirecting and refocusing and looking upon themselves? You know, because I look at the mirror, okay? That is a very powerful tool in that if one can look within that physical mirror and look at themselves in their eyes to see what's inside of themselves, maybe, just maybe, there could be an awareness and something that can be changed. And so, I don't know, I just kind of, I'm just curious on how do we work towards
something, akin to hypnosis is something as simple, believe it or not, as breathing and meditations.
Okay.
Again, without the whole ideal of anything obstructing the body, like chemicals and things of that nature. And then we get into the psychotropics, and some people do need medication. Unfortunately, we live in a society that capitalism reigns, and, you know, there's an over use of, you know, psychotropics, because, you know, now you're talking about big money, pharmacological intervention is often not needed, but sometimes it is, you know. So there's various ways that people get well, but the probably the most fundamental is being grounded in a belief system. And you're correct, it doesn't always have to be Afrocentric, but it has to be person-centered, that we're working with people, you know, getting some form of knowledge for themselves. And hopefully with African people, we are moving them towards. And you don't always have to say that for it to be, you know, Afrocentric. That uh-huh. makes sense, you know.
Yeah. Uhuru, brothers, thank you so very much.
All I'll right. be listening. Peace and blessings, brother. Milwaukee 0118. Milwaukee 0118. Any questions or comments? Okay. Milwaukee 9139. Milwaukee 9139. Any questions or comments?
I just love this show. It's a very, very good show. This is right up my alley.
All right. Thank you, sister. Thank you for listening in.
Thank you, sister. Thank you.
You're so welcome.
Milwaukee 8233. Milwaukee 8233. Any of the comments? 8233. Any questions or comments? Okay. Milwaukee 6051. 6051. Any questions or comments? 6051. All right. All right, brother. If you, the last question as it relates to the chemical dependency in the era of what you're seeing with our people, what have you seen that is working for our
well,
people?
Well, I do want to do this because I think that we were speaking of culture and things of that nature. I was blessed to Brother Michael Van, who is a brother who had just changed and went to the ancestors 2 or 3 weeks ago. And I think it's important for us to do this because we were talking about IV drug use. And there was there are cultural programs that have worked. And the program was for IV drug user males. And we used Black History as our curriculum. We did a lot of things centered around the seven principles of Kwanzaa and things of that nature. So I think various things work, but what does work is the abstinence of those chemicals and getting people in an environmental positive environment, which, you know, is without those chemicals being introduced.
The problem, of course, is that most of us come from an environment that who are chemically dependent. And again, in our community, drug houses are rampant. There's a liquor store, more liquor stores in Milwaukee than there are churches. And so what needs to happen is getting people out of the environment, dealing with those traumas is something we haven't talked about, which induces a lot of people to use and stuff. And we just can label the whole community PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. So many people do use off of their feelings and off the trauma that they've been exposed to and have been exposed to. So there's a lot of work which has been done by Dr. Carl Bell, his clinic in Chicago, where it was found when you empower various neighborhoods and communities, there's a decrease of drug use. And that empowerment is like, you know, what we call block clubs, people being involved in, you know, things that are, you know, relevant to the community and locus of control. So just taking a person and putting them into a 12-step program in and of itself, then putting them back into, you know, the community or the community in which they've been addicted to oftentimes is self-defeatist. You know, people need jobs, people need businesses, people need education. There's a lot of reasons why people use. It's not just hedonistic desire to, you know, escape and zoom. I like to fly away, but yeah, I would, because the world that I'm living in is traumatic. You know,
that's deep. That's deep. We brought up Brother Carl Bell. His concept was built around resilience factors. Could you touch a little more on that? Because I think a lot of times when we talk about from a cultural perspective, capitalism breeds a dysfunctionality in our cultural orientation. It manufactures these values, these are interests and our principles. And when another culture manufactures your values, your interests, your behavior benefits that culture. And so since the function of the racism and the institutional, the systemic structural institutional racism, we internalize that our values are impacted by it. But Carl Bell talked about some resilience factors, which cuts close to that.
Yeah, he also talks about value system changes. He also did something that I think that, you know, we lose track of. I became familiar with him in the 80s, PTSD just came into the DSM, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, and he did a thing about brain trauma amongst children. He worked a lot with children and stuff. And Dr. Carl Bell looked at the person, in our particular case, black people, in a holistic, he was a physician, a psychiatrist, and what he would do, not only would he talk about changing the value systems and how we saw our construct of the world, but also he would look at things like, you know, doing neurological workups, doing things that, you know, encompass more than just, you know, looking at a person, asking questions, and send them their way, you know. And so often that's missing in our assessments of dealing with our people. And so he found that, you know, a high percentage of children who came through the clinic also had brain trauma damage, also had lead poisoning, which is very high in our community. Mm-hmm. Lead poisoning, then, you know, mimics things like attention deficit disorders. Well, if you could reduce or get the lead out of a child give them an appropriate diet with therapy, then you could, and family as well, you could address those things. He was more holistic as well as, you know, just the change of values and things of that nature and stuff. Something that's really missing, because so then it speaks to the whole medical model of looking at us holistically, which is an African people, and that's what we do. We look at we don't just take fragments of anything. We look at the, and how it affects the entire village and stuff, you know. So,
I say. And what you was talking about is called nutrient therapy. And mm-hmm. I'm working hard to get it's a brother and a sister that runs a clinic in Waukegan. It's in Illinois. It's called Mensa Clinic. And what you just articulated is the practice that they're doing, and it deals with methylation. And methylation is just how the processes of how your DNA molecules function, how your genetics function. And your genetics function based on the balance of certain chemicals and nutrients in your body. So, so it's a blood test that they do to find out what copper level is in your body, the lead level, the protein, your zinc, all of that, once again, looks at how your physicality of your body, and then your psychiatric as well. That's in our body. So what you just talking about, I'm working hard to get them on the show. But my sister from Greensboro, see, she's back. You got a question or comment?
Yes, I have a comment. Greetings, family. How's everybody?
Greetings.
Okay. I'm just so grateful that we have African-centered solutions consistently on this talk talk radio network show. It's just a beautiful thing. It is so necessary because, as oppressed people, for so long we've done the Western way. We've looked at symptoms and tried to cure symptoms instead of going deeper into the cause and the root of a problem or an illness. So that's what, as has been said today, that's what we do as African people. We deal with issues holistically, and we get to the root of the issue so we can pull it out and thereby getting rid of the whole dis-ease, state of dis-ease. I also was in the field of addiction for several years and a recovering person myself. And I want to speak about talk therapy, because if one is willing to get really, really honest about how they feel, how one feels, it really is effective. But we've been taught and programmed, through trauma, to not be honest about how we feel. So in the beginning, in my own recovery, and then when I started working with others, I recognized how difficult it was for Black people to say how we really felt, to articulate how we really felt. But when I would work with white clients or be in some kind of seminar or whatever with whites, I found it much easier to articulate their feelings, because we've been shut down. You can't say how you feel. Mm-hmm. You can't talk about this white man that just raped your wife. You can't talk about, this cracker that just beat you up for looking him in the eye. So for the first time in history, we're allowing ourselves to speak our truth honestly without being punished, in terms of a healing process. So talk therapy I have found to be so critical. I want to share, I've shared this before in the past, I've had a sister circle in my home for many years. After learning the power of talk therapy, I didn't charge anybody. I didn't do anything. I said, come here if you want to talk about your trauma, your addiction, whatever, and come here and do it. And there were just some phenomenal things that happened. One situation was that just stood out to me that I like to share with people. A sister came, and she started talking about being molested and, the hell that she went through as a child. And we didn't even get to things like internalized depression and post-traumatic slave disorder. We started with childhood issues. And as the sister started talking, she started screaming. And she screamed like somebody was torturing her. And she screamed for so long that we started getting scared. There were about 30 of us in a circle. We started getting scared, concerned, because she just wouldn't stop. Eventually, she stopped. Circle ended after a while, and the sister just disappeared. and we were concerned about, you know, where she was. Eventually, I ran into the sister about a couple of years later, and I said, what happened to you? I tried to contact you, couldn't contact you. She said, sister, I came to that circle, and I released years of anger and pain and grief. She said, I just released it, and we couldn't stop her. So there was another force. I believe it was her ancestors were working with her, you know. And that sister just released, and she said, I am happy. I'm married. I've got children. A great. Oh, I just, I was blown away. And that's one of the more stark, you know, situations that we've had. But I just want to emphasize the importance of talk therapy in addition to everything we do, because what I've learned is that first comes the pain that, you know, oppressed people, we're human. We're gonna medicate. We're going to try to escape chronic pain.
Right.
You know? So first comes the pain. Then comes the cognitive, you know, issues where we can't think clearly because now, you know, all of our brain chemicals and endorphins and all this stuff is all crazy. And then comes the bad attitude. And then comes the acting out. So this is like a four-step process, you know, maybe not in that order all the time, but, you know, oftentimes that's how we've treated it. And so, you know, understanding these things and being able to articulate these things is so critical. And ultimately, oh, another thing, brother, you talked about the guest. Brother, what is your name, please?
Brother Fossey.
Okay, Brother Fossey, thank you so much. Yeah, I think you mentioned something about the games that are played in the military.
Oh, that was Brother Fonzo who said that.
Okay, so so that situation. I also had a short experience with that I want to share. There was a brother in the military. His wife was talking about how he was not conscious. She was trying to get him conscious, but he was addicted to the games, which I know nothing about, but these gaming systems, and was spending thousands of dollars. Long story short, I spent a couple of hours with this brother, and I'm not saying how many, you know, but anyway, let's just say the ancestors and spirits work with him. Brother just developed the consciousness once he heard the stark truth, and as long as he was with us and had something constructive to do toward working toward his own people's liberation, he was not touching any of that stuff because the addictions were replaced with something constructive and with something that fed him and that was helping in the process of liberation of his people. Once he got away from that, he went right back to addiction. So replacing those addictions with things that free us is also critical.
But you know, sister, one of the things that you said, if I may, is that talking therapy works when you're in a trusting environment. So what you were able to provide was trust and environment. So many of the people who have come to me, our people, have been in therapy before, but, you know, the person across the table or the chair or whatever didn't ask the right questions. You'd be surprised at how many misdiagnosed, particularly black females who were labeled in the public setting. They went into for some acute issues. They were schizophrenic or bipolar. But in reality, no one ever even asked them, had you ever been sexually abused?
Mm-hmm.
They say questions that never, you know. So we went down that hallway of PTSD. Now, that's a totally different treatment plan. That's a totally different, you know, therapy model than, you know, bipolarity. So there are people who are bipolar, but I'm just saying oftentimes when you're in white supremacist type of institutions, they just got, you know, these boilerplate diagnoses based upon symptomatology without going deep. So there's a level of trust that people have when they're sitting next to you to talk and stuff. And the other thing about in terms of addiction, I remember when I went through therapy, I never, you know, we were taught not to talk about our family systems, many of us. And this white woman, I was in a place called, I don't know if you're down south, a place called Oshkosh, which is a predominantly Caucasian-centered place. And they were asking me about my family, you know, and I wasn't going to tell them this stuff about my family. And your business, we don't talk about that kind of stuff.
after I did reveal to her, you know, she told me I was an adult child of an alcoholic. You know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I still didn't buy into that because, you know, my father was a functional World War II vet who drank because he got ran out of the South for standing up to white people. In other words, she didn't even understand the context of, you know, our, you know, relationship with alcohol or with ourselves and stuff. So the people who are opening up to you have to feel secure and safe that you understand the road that they're walking down. And oftentimes, when you're, that's why I'm so glad that Brother Alfonso and others, because they're younger than me, you're talking about. When I was in the military, I don't even think they had cell phones in the Vietnam era. With no games. But nevertheless, my point is these young brothers and sisters who are coming behind me so I can finally hang up my boots are coming with those type of, you know, there's more of us now. There's more of us who have a African-centered mindset where our people can receive, because it makes no difference if a person goes and talks to someone that they can't relate to or they don't feel the comfort level that, you know, is needed, or the person is not even competent enough to even ask the right questions or make a person feel secure enough to, you know, open up, if you will.
I say. And can I say quickly, that's why I started off saying that I'm so glad that we're using African-centered modalities now, because we understand each other. They don't. I mean, they're the root of the problem, the cause of the problem. And another quick thing, during Jim Crow, when we were being lynched, hanging from trees, all that horrible stuff burned alive, I recently found out, I didn't know, that cocaine addiction was huge.
Mm-hmm.
Cocaine addiction and, of course, alcohol addiction. And that was how, one of the ways that our ancestors, not so far back, coped and anesthetized themselves from the horrors of Jim Crow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So thanks for listening.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Milwaukee. 1,000 is your last four. 1,000. You got any questions or comments? Milwaukee, 1,000. Okay. All right. It's 7:51. We touched on a number of different things. So closing. Would you like to give us a little more insight or perspective, your perspective of moving forward? How do we begin to help our brothers with what we're seeing in their behaviors? How do we begin to move on that?
We have to develop our own institutions. It doesn't do us, you know, I mean, many of us are working, you know, most of the people who I know are working for Eurocentric systems. And it's incongruent to, you know, oftentimes trying to help our people. And it becomes imperative that we have control of our own destiny when we're talking about, as therapists I'm talking about, control of our narrative, our paradigm, and, you know, how we relate to the people that we're servicing and to empower them. I think that's, you know, the ultimate, you know, goal that we have. But in the meantime, we need to educate ourselves. We need to get African-centered ourselves as treatment providers. We need to take care of ourselves, you know, and do those things that are, you know, necessary, and continue to read people like who we're honoring today, Dr. Wilson and Dr. France Fanon and Dr. Bell and Dr. Francis. Help me.
Yes, Dr. Francis Cress Wilson.
Right, we need to develop those techniques and ideologies and therapeutic modalities that they left for us behind us. Those are our ancestors. We have to do that. We can't, you know, the baton is being held out to us to run and continue. That's one black man's opinion.
Right, man. We appreciate that, man. I want to, family, one of our master teachers, Wade Nobles, is doing a webinar, family, I think it's the 18th or the 17th of this month, on the science of Black African psychology and the implementation of that. I know you can go to the Black Psychologist of Houston Facebook page, and I know it's on there. I can't, I'm just trying to remember where it's at. So I do know that Baba Wade Knowles is going to be doing a webinar on Black African psychology. So that's something that we can chime into. Dr. Rogers, you got anything you want to, questions you want to add, anything you want to say?
No, excellent program, brother. Excellent, excellent. Brother Fossey did a magnificent job. You might want to remind your audience that they can get this rebroadcast and go to the website at www.timepointawakening.com. And you can kind of let them know about that if you like, and maybe some of your upcoming programs that you're planning to do.
Okay, Baba, thank you. Once again, these programs are being recorded, and you can once again go to www.timepointawakening.com, and you can download the programs. They are under the Black Think Tank Creative, Black Think Tank Radio. We have our own section, so show that you're listening to now is the Elders of Sankofa. Dr. Rogers' show is Black Think Tank Radio.
It's a Black Reality Think Tank.
Thank you, Baba. But any other shows, and once again, I'm hoping that Queen Mother combined, that theirs are being recorded so that we can go back and get the knowledge and the science that they drop in as well. But once again, family, it is truly always a pleasure and an honor to be with y'all. We will continue this conversation. Once again, in a short period of time, we've tried to cover some information that requires a much more time to talk about. We can go much more in depth. But once again, with that said, family, one love and safe travels.
One love.